From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
I was sitting in a crummy movie with my hands on my chin.
On today's Fresh Air, record producer Don Was pays tribute to Brian Wilson, the genius of the Beach Boys. Was has made a new documentary about Brian Wilson called I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. Wilson and Was co-produced a new companion CD. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg reveals his favorite word. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
So, love and mercy to you and your friends tonight. I was lying in my room and the news came on TV. A lot of
first, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A top record producer pays homage to a pop music genius in the new film I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. The documentary is about Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys. He was their lead vocalist, songwriter, arranger, and producer. Although their early songs sang of fun, 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 Brian Wilson has had terrible depressions and nervous breakdowns. The new documentary tries to make connections between his life and his songs. It will be shown this Sunday night on the Disney Channel and will soon open theatrically around the country. The director, Don Was, is best known for the successful records he's produced for Bonnie Raitt, the Rolling Stones, and the B-52s. He used to co-lead the band Was Not Was. He and Brian Wilson co-produced a CD companion to the new film that includes a new performance of one of Wilson's best ballads, The Warmth of the Sun.
What good is the dawn that grows into day? The sunset at night.
Don Was had always been a fan of Brian Wilson's work. Was met Wilson at a party in 1989. They became friends and even played some gigs together. But Was told me it was difficult to convince Wilson to participate in a documentary.
Yeah, it was really hard, especially a film that was about his past. I mean, I think he's dredged that up one time too many, you know, for his own liking. And he'd also written about 40 new songs and was very anxious to record those and really wasn't all that excited about going back and redoing some of his older songs. What I explained to him, I gave him my sushi defense. Which is that when you order sushi in a restaurant, they put some ginger on there to help you cleanse your palate in between courses. And I said, you need that. You've been the victim of this kind of bad publicity. And in order for people to approach your new music with an open mind, they need to cleanse, you know, the sordid details of, you know, aspects of your life, you know, from their memory and get reacquainted with what's great about your music. So he bought that.
Is that why your film focuses mostly on his songs as opposed to on some of the more tragic aspects of his life?
Well, truthfully, I'm a musician, you know. I'm a bass player. So I made a film about what I know. I wouldn't know how to begin analyzing his psychological treatment. I'm not even qualified to formulate an opinion about that. Or, you know, for example, I mean, what I know about is music, and I thought that's what let's make a film about Brian's music, and we'll deal with his life to the extent that it impacted his music making.
Were there conditions that he or any other members of the family gave you before they agreed to participate?
No, it was wide open.
What impact has Brian Wilson's songs or his production style had on you as a songwriter or as a producer?
Well, a phenomenal impact. I think he's the guy who broke out of that 3 or 4 chord kind of structure and really started taking rock and roll songs to highly unconventional places, melodically and structure-wise. He threw out all the rules about composition and was, you know, really creative with that. I think what he did in the studio, especially considering that, you know, there weren't even synthesizers back then. So in order for him to create a new texture, he had to get a bunch of guys. He'd have a harp player and a harmonica player and a guitar player and a clarinet player. And he'd say, all right, all you guys play the same note. And he would create a new texture out of these 4 sounds, you know, playing in unison. Well, that's essentially what sampling's all about, you know, but there were no machines to do that then. You know, now you just do that in a keyboard, and that's where all these new textures come from. But he realized that you could, you know, paint with some new colors, and he was the first to do it. He really is the first rock and roll impressionist.
Now, you grew up in Detroit, and I know you really loved a lot of black music when you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is that the Beach Boys might have sounded really white to you, and mm-hmm. that maybe you didn't like them that much when you were young.
Well, you know, I did like them a lot. But this is something I've come to realize. Brian was heavily influenced by the 4 Freshmen.
Oh, yeah, you can't get any whiter than that.
You can't get it. That's pretty white stuff. But really, if you go back and analyze the harmonies, to me, they're like descended from Duke Ellington. It's really, it's cleaned up, but if you're just, you know, going to go in there and look at the notes and the harmonic structures of the voicings, they're pretty hip, actually, and rooted in, you know, I think Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington. So, you know, there's... You know, really, if you're making any kind of pop music in America today, there's no getting away from the influence of black music through the years. So, you know, maybe there's a tie in there. But I am a white guy from Detroit, so of course I like the Beach Boys. You know, it's just the whole imagery of the, you know, I think that was it. As a teenager, I didn't really know how to analyze musically what was happening, but the imagery of the California dream, the whole surfing, driving a Woody, and the blonde girls on the beach, that, you know, what could appeal more to a kid who's, you know, landlocked in this auto town?
Pick a song for me that maybe sounds different to you now than it did when it first came out. Maybe sounds better to you now than it did when it first came out. You see more, you hear more in it.
Well, a good example, there's a song that we perform in the film called Till I Die, which I thought was, you know, a fairly depressing song at the time about a guy going through a bad time. What I subsequently became enamored of was the chord changes. When I had to perform the song with Brian, I wrote out a chart of the music, and I looked at this thing, and I said, man, this is in no key. It starts in D, but it moves in a really bizarre cycle of chords. It's kind of reminiscent of, Giant Steps, the John Coltrane song, but even more complex. And in fact, I asked him about it. I said, how do you write something like that? What are you thinking when you sit down at the piano and you start going to all these unlikely places? And he said he was looking at his fingers and arranging his hands in interesting geometric patterns while trying not to move the highest note and the lowest note. And I thought, wow, what a wildly skewed method of songwriting. I mean, who would think of that? But that's the beauty of that's why he's a genius, because he could approach something like that from such a different place. It's kind of Zen songwriting in a way, isn't it? He goes in with this beginner's mind, no preconceptions about what a song should be, and he looks at the patterns of his hands.
Well, Till I Die is featured on the CD mm-hmm. that you produced with Brian Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Should we hear that?
Let's.
Rolling on.
Glenn Wilson from the new CD, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, which is a companion CD to the new documentary about Brian Wilson. The CD was co-produced by Wilson and my guest Don Was. Don Was directed the new documentary. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Don Was. He directed a new documentary about Brian Wilson. What was it like for you knowing that you were going to go into the studio with Brian Wilson to produce recordings by him, given how much you admire his own production style? I mean, did you have to figure out what you thought was the best sound for him?
I had to figure out what I was supposed to do, you know? I mean, he's the greatest
right.
producer of all
he's
time.
He's the genius of production, yeah.
What do you want me there for? You know, I found a little role for myself in there, but I wanted to watch him work. You know, it's a voyeuristic learning experience for me, you know.
Yeah, what did you learn from watching him, from working with him?
Well, just it's this kind of Zen thing, just having an open mind, listen to the sound in your head and try to capture that on tape, and don't have any preconceived notions about what it's supposed to be, or what the whether what the radio is going to think about it, or whether it's a commercial song or not. Just hear the sound in your head and go after it.
Now, did he go in knowing exactly what sound he wanted, or did you both tinker a lot while you were there?
He's really amazing. There's another song that we didn't put on this album, a new studio recording. He had an idea for an arrangement on the Creedence Clearwater song "Proud Mary." It's a really weird take on the song, and we went into the studio. We actually did it before we made this film, and it was the first time that he'd gone into a room of maybe 13 musicians who were waiting there for his direction since the '60s. It's how he made all his records, through Pet Sounds, and then synthesizers came in, and he got used to overdubbing and everything. So he walked in, and here these guys didn't know, what to expect of him. And the first thing he said was, okay, now in the middle of the song, we're going to stop for 25 bars, and I just want the drums to play quarter notes on the hi-hat. And everyone looked at him like he was out of his mind, because 25 bars of nothing in the middle of a record it's excruciatingly long. It's like a minute and a half of nothing, And we thought that, all right, we'll go along with this. I don't know what he's talking about. We can always edit it out. And man, he knew every note that was supposed to be overdubbed on top of that minute and a half, and as he started doing the overdubs, it became clear that the whole thing was planned out. He couldn't take the time to explain it. You just had to make that leap of faith with him.
How come you didn't include it on the CD?
We never finished it. It's also the CD is the soundtrack from the film. The performances that are in the film make up the CD. And in fact, Brian had wanted to put some new material on there, but I said, yeah, save it. This is a very specific thing from the film, and he's getting ready to make a new record this fall.
My guest is Don Was. He directed the new documentary on Brian Wilson called I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, and that's also the title of the new CD that's a companion to the film. The movie is so much about Brian Wilson's approach to songwriting and producing. Some of my favorite parts of the movie are about Brian Wilson alone at the piano, kind of demonstrating his approach to songwriting. Mm. There's even a scene in it where he sings with his mother, mm-hmm. singing backup, and his brother Carl
right.
doing backup. I think the song is In My Room.
They did In My Room together. Yeah.
How did you get them to do that? I mean, I don't imagine he still sings with his mother a lot.
They hadn't done that in, I'm sure, 35, 40 years, since they were little kids living at home. I think it's probably... it's probably symbolic of the attempt that this fractured family is making to, heal old wounds and, reconcile with each other. It was a really poignant moment.
So did you ask them to do it? Did you try to encourage them to get together?
Yeah, I thought it would you know, I thought it would... I'll tell you truthfully, what I see in there is not only three people who've really been through it with each other making a real genuine effort to hold it together, but also you can, in the nuance, you can see what pulled them apart. You can see the forces at play that that made the family crumble. It's, in an impressionistic sense, it's the whole story right there. You almost don't need the interviews.
Well, I love this part here. Can we play this excerpt of the film with Brian at the piano singing lead and his brother Carl and his mother?
Sure.
Doing backup in my room.
In this world I look out all my worries and my fears in my room, in my room, in my room.
It's an excerpt from the new film directed by Don Was called I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, a film about Brian Wilson. Was it tempting to produce a record with him just like this, just like in his living room at the piano?
It almost is that. You know, I think that the performances were very, it was a really informal setting, you know, as you can see in the film, with people sort of in a semicircle looking at each other and not, you know, no headphones, no baffles or anything like that.
One of the songs that you include in the film is Caroline No.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk to Marilyn Wilson, Brian Wilson's first wife, about her reaction when she heard this song. I think I'll play an excerpt of what she has to say from your film.
Great.
Where is the girl I used to know? I just really took it personally. How did you lose that happy glow? Well, you know, I mean, I was like telling him off all the time and getting mad at him because he was being, you know, very naughty. It's such a great song. I mean, the way he sings it with that whine that only Brian has with that wonderful voice. And then the ending, you know, that, oh, Caroline, no. The way he goes, no. Oh, God, it's killer.
It really moved me hearing that. I loved what she had to say and how personally she took the song, even though he didn't write the lyric.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of those lyrics, you know, if you talk to Tony Asher, who was his co-writer in that period of time, Tony said that Brian would basically come in and talk about what was on his mind and give Tony a feeling, a mood, a topic, and Tony would expand on it. I feel that Pet Sounds is a very, it's weird because it's an extremely personal record, that knowing Brian, I understand that that these are important emotional components of his being there, and yet the lyrics were actually written by someone else, but I think that they were based on sentiments that Brian was expressing.
Is this song one of your favorites?
Oh, I love that one. I also love his interpretation of it now. On the original version, he sings in this kind of innocent choir boy voice, and I think it's much more expressive now because you hear, you know, that this is a guy who's been through the ringer. You hear a kind of world weariness in his voice, and yet you also hear this naivete and innocence that characterizes his personality. It's a wild juxtaposition.
Why don't we play the new version, which is featured on the CD, on the new CD.
Great.
This is Brian Wilson, Caroline No.
Where did your long hair? Sweet thing died, oh Caroline.
I ever find in you again? Things that made me love you so much then, could we ever bring them back once they have gone? Oh, Caroline.
Brian Wilson from his new CD, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, the CD co-produced by Don Was, who also directed the new film documentary on Brian Wilson. You include in the film, and I'm glad to say on the new CD, a song of Brian Wilson's that was never released before.
Mm.
And this is, I guess, a home recording that he made
yeah.
in 1976.
Yeah.
The song is called Still I Dream of It. I really like this a lot. And, of course, you know, the recordings are a little rough, but I love hearing that kind of demo recording.
Oh, yeah, I think it's really effective, yeah.
Tell me why this reached you and how you found the demo.
Well, it was, you know, a lot of his work is bootlegged. There's a real network of Brian Wilson fanatics out there. And somehow it came in. I don't know how I got a hold of it. I thought it was incredible. I think it's an amazing song. This is a period when he was supposedly not getting out of bed and was in, you know, dire emotional straits. And yet I think it's one of the best songs he ever wrote. It starts with some of the most mundane lyrics ever in a rock and roll song. And you think, oh boy, this guy's gone. And within about a minute, he's dealing with some of the most profound metaphysical questions posed to man, and it's brilliant the way he moves from that, from the simple to the complex, and makes it seem so natural.
Did he write the lyric for this?
Yeah, he wrote the whole thing himself.
Why don't we hear it?
Great.
This was a demo recording made in 1976.
Time for supper now. Day's been hard and I'm so tired, I feel like eating now. Smell the kitchen now, hear the maid whistle a tune, my thoughts are fleeting now. Still I dream of it, of that happy day when I can say I've fallen in love. And it haunts me so, like a dream that's somehow linked to all the stars above.
Did Brian Wilson mind you using a demo?
No, he never objected. I don't think so. He tried to. In fact, he did record the song with an orchestra. And if you buy the, there's a box set out on Capitol Records with a lot of never-before-released songs, and this is one of them. I don't think he came close to the emotional impact of the demo in the final recording. It all kind of got washed away in a slick sea of strings.
Don Was directed the Brian Wilson documentary, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Don Was produced Bonnie Raitt's comeback album and the Rolling Stones album Voodoo Lounge. Coming up in part two of our conversation, Don Was talks about his work as a record producer. Was co-produced Brian Wilson's new CD, which is a companion to Was's documentary film about Wilson. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg has something that I don't, a favorite word. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new documentary, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, focuses on the life and songs of Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys' lead singer, songwriter, arranger, and producer. The film was made by someone who knows what it takes to produce a successful record, Don Was. He produced Bonnie Raitt's Grammy-sweeping comeback record, the B-52's hit Love Shack, the Rolling Stones' Voodoo Lounge, and the anthology Rhythm, Country, and Blues, which featured a series of improbable duets pairing performers like Al Green and Lyle Lovett. This is part two of my conversation with Don Was. This is your first film, but you've produced a whole lot of records. Mm-hmm. And yet, you recently said in an interview, I believe the days of audio-only music are over, and today's record producer is akin to the director of radio plays in 1950. Mm-hmm. What do you think that?
Well, there are two reasons, really. It's the first of all the exciting new technologies that are being introduced today are all, you know, visually oriented. So if you want to, if you're an artist and you want to dabble in this, these new mediums that are being discovered, you can't just deal only with audio aspects of things. And the audience is now, and now consists in a large part of a generation, a couple generations of people who were raised watching music on MTV. So these are people who don't necessarily separate the visual from the audio anymore. So I think you have to address this. I think that there are really exciting opportunities in art right now where the technological innovations have created possibilities to invent new mediums that incorporate aspects of computer programming and filmmaking and music. I think rock and roll bands 5 years from now will actually consist of a guy who can make some music and someone who's knows how to run a Hi-8 camera and a computer programmer.
Is it ever frustrating for you in your role as record producer to know that some people are restless with music only now? They want that visual component.
Is people in the audience, you mean?
Yeah. Is that frustrating for you when you're producing a record?
Not really. I understand what you're saying. I think that there's great beauty and validity to recorded music. I think that when you're trying to make the perfect record, you're leaving something to the imagination. In a way, you are addressing the visual sense, but it's by implication. You leave space in there for people to fill in something visual and picture. Just, again, we'll use the radio play analogy, where you didn't see anything, but certainly you closed your eyes and saw the Green Hornet or whoever, the shadow. You know, you did visualize, but the listener visualized. I think that's a problem with music videos today, is that, in fact, if you've made a perfect record, you've left just enough to the imagination, and then at the 11th hour, they bring some guy in with a bunch of smoke, and he's your director, and you do some things that are completely disconnected from the artist's original inspiration for the sake of getting airplay on MTV, and you end up with this unsightly growth on top of your perfect work. The real goal for me is to try to organically unite these things, to sit a songwriter down with the screenwriter at the, you know, from the outset, and come up with something that's really inextricably linked.
What have you been listening to lately? What's on your CD changer at home or in the car?
Good question. I've been working with the Rolling Stones, and when I work with them, I start listening to what they play in the hotel rooms, and so it's a lot of Muddy Waters, a lot of older stuff.
The Stones are still listening to Muddy Waters?
Oh, yeah. In fact, when I had a great musicology course when we were making the Voodoo Lounge album, because my hotel room was right above Keith's, and Keith plays music all night long really loud, which is probably why they stuck me over him, yeah. But I got turned on to all Keith. You know, I don't think he listens to much music that was recorded past 1965. A lot of Muddy Waters, a lot of great old blues, the Jive 5, he went through a phase where he's playing the Jive 5 all night long. But also Corelli. That's what really shocked me, is that when he wakes up at 7 in the evening, he plays a little Corelli with his breakfast. Yeah.
That's funny. Your professional name is Don Was. That's a name that you took on for the group Was Not Was, with your partner then, David Weiss, who took the name David Was. Are you ever going to go back to your birth name, Don Fagenson?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, it wasn't a real deliberate thing. It was kind of a joke. And then, you know, 10 years later, you're registering in a hotel under the name. It's kind of weird. I mean, even my birth name is some fraudulent thing that my grandfather came up with. I don't even know what the family name is. He came through Ellis Island and he thought the Tsar was on his, you know, like two steps behind him, ready to drag him back to Russia. So when the immigration officer said, what's your name? He said, Vergosen, which is Yiddish for forgotten. So they wrote down Ferguson, and then someone said, that's not a Jewish name, that's Irish. So he came up with Fagenson. I don't know what, that's as fictitious as was.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So does anyone in your family feel bad that it's not your fashion, that the name that's becoming famous is Was and not Fagenson? Everybody dreams of their family name becoming really famous.
They're all changing their name to Was.
That's right. are you still in touch with David Weiss, who used to be your partner in Was Not Was?
Yeah, through intermediaries.
Oh.
Through our lawyers. That's not true. No lawyers involved.
Oh, well.
I'll tell you something. There's a dynamic to a band that is universal, whether you're 12-year-old kids putting your first group together in a garage or whether you're the Beach Boys or the Rolling Stones. And there's an element of internal combustion. My theory is that you start out with the whole world to conquer, and you're united in this struggle to, you know, get a record deal, to build an audience, to get your record played on radio stations, to play larger venues. Then all of a sudden you accomplish some of these things, and this combative gene that's in you starts looking for new things to conquer, and you ultimately turn to the closest thing at hand and eat your brother.
Well, nice to have a sense of humor about it. You've produced records by really successful records by a lot of people, including Bonnie Raitt, the Rolling Stones, the B-52s, Bob Dylan. Do lots of people come up to you now who want to revive their careers and think that you're going to have the magic touch?
I read about that tag more than it actually comes into play. I don't think artists think that way.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to think is that it's not so much a resuscitation act that I perform, but that in fact what I do as a producer is to try to get to the essence of what the artist is about, what it is that they're trying to say at that particular point in time, and to stay true to that, to not allow production or commercial values or the need to get played on the radio to interfere with that vision. And as it happens, when, you know, I think, like, for example, with Bonnie, when we returned a little more to her roots and stopped worrying about whether she was radio friendly or not, she became commercial because she made a more honest record. And I think that's true of anybody. I think listeners can spot a cynical endeavor.
What if you think a song isn't great, but the person whose album it is really wedded to it?
It would depend. I would certainly tell them. I feel that the artist is paying you a lot of money to be there to watch their back, and that's your gig. So if you don't tell them, who's going to tell them? That's why you're there. They don't have me in the studio because I'm such a nice, loyal fan that they thought they'd reward me with a free concert. You know, I'm there. That's my job. So I do tell them. On the other hand, if someone feels strongly about something, I always go with the artist. I'll argue with them. But, you know, I don't believe in dictating to them. I just want to make sure that they really feel strongly about it.
My guest is musician and record producer Don Was. He also directed the new Brian Wilson documentary, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with record producer and film director Don Was. Is it ever hard to be really honest with a performer who you grew up listening to and who you were really enamored with when you were growing up, like maybe the Rolling Stones or Bob Dylan?
No, I actually find that the greater these people are, the more receptive they are to at least having a dialogue about it. They're not necessarily going to listen to you. But they don't, you know, I haven't had a problem with that. I think that the great rock and roll artists do what they do because they're rebels, and because they don't want a boss. They don't want to answer to anybody. So if you come after someone and say, that song's, you know, a load of rubbish, well, of course they're going to take offense at that and probably try to do the opposite of what it is that you're saying, you know, what you're suggesting. But, you know, if you just have a reasonable dialogue, like, are you sure you don't maybe want to write a chorus for the song? you know, I think there's a way to do it so that you're merely acting as an extension of their self-evaluation faculties.
Now, I understand that you're often not in the control room. You're in the studio with the performers.
Right. Yeah.
What's the advantage of that?
Well, there's a very practical thing. First of all, you know, if people are using headphones in the studio, it sounds really different than, you know, the way it sounds coming through these, you know, huge speakers that are blasting in the control room. And I think you need to be in the space that the artist is in. You know, I think you need to hear what they're hearing. So I sit out there with the headphones on and listen to that. But also, I like to be in there with the band. If, you know, everyone should be looking at each other. I don't believe in overdubbing too much. I think that the band should be there. I care less about bleed through of acoustic reflections than I care about eye contact. I like to have everyone in the same room, and you get this kind of open communication going. I think that a band that's listening to a singer will do certain things in response to what the singer does that the singer will then feed off of and respond to. They keep feeding each other, and ultimately you want to elevate through communication to a more expressive record.
When you're not playing on a session and you're just producing it and you're in the studio with the performers as they're playing, isn't it sometimes uncomfortable to make eye contact with them?
Well, yeah, I don't mean you stare Mick Jagger down while he's...
I didn't mean to stare him down, but I know, like, when I'm doing a concert with somebody in the studio here, mm-hmm. like someone's at the piano singing and or they're playing guitar or something, mm-hmm. I'll often just, like, walk out of their line of vision so that they don't have to worry if they look up. They'll be making eye contact with me, and it will seem as if there's something personal happening in the song.
Well, you know, so a lot of times I close my eyes because it can be really deceptive. For example, take a guy like Mick Jagger who, when he's doing a vocal on a record, is holding the microphone. Now, it's not on a stand. He holds it and moves around like he does on stage.
Mm-hmm.
But he's 5 feet away from me. It's the greatest show on earth. And yet you don't want the fact that it looks cool and you're enjoying it to temper your evaluation of the performance.
Right.
So sometimes if you take the visuals into consideration, it'll deceive you. So I close my eyes and try to, you know, perceive the way it's going to work recorded.
How much are you performing now that you're so well known as a producer?
Yeah, not nearly enough. It's really frustrating. In fact, last night I was in New York and I had a couple hours free, and Willie Nelson, who's an artist that I work with, was staying at the same hotel as me, and he was on David Letterman. He said, well, come on and play bass. So, yeah, I jumped at the chance. I'd go play a bar mitzvah if someone called me.
You'll get a lot of calls. I can see a lot of people going to their phones right now. Did you used to play a lot of bar mitzvahs?
I did.
What did you play?
I earned a great living as a 12, 13-year-old. We we had a little band, and we used to play, like, Beatles songs when the violin band would take their break. And we'd get, like, you know, $10 each or something like that to play on three breaks during a wedding or a bar mitzvah to entertain the kids. So I was a young boy with $100 in my pocket at any given moment from this. It was a cottage industry we had going in Detroit.
You know, it's funny. I think that's another job that's been wiped out. The bar mitzvahs I've been to lately, they all have DJs playing, you know, like rap records. So there's no bands anymore.
That's sacrilegious, is what it is.
So are you in a band yourself now?
Well, I'm making my own record with some of the guys from Was Not Was, and let's see, on some of the sessions that Herbie Hancock's been playing, and Terrence Blanchard, and Sheila E., among other people. And what I'm doing, actually, is I've got this music, which is actually a reworking of old Hank Williams songs to the point of unrecognizability. Mm. And I'm making a short film to go with it, and it'll be released as a CD plus, and I'm going to direct it. Francis Coppola's producing it. And the idea is to kind of deal with what we were talking about before, which is to inextricably link the music to the narrative. So in developing the screenplay, we're leaving room for the lyrics to the songs. And, you know, likewise choosing songs that, you know, that advance the story a little bit. So hopefully when you buy this thing as a CD plus, you'll pop it in, you'll watch the 20-minute film, and it'll enhance your enjoyment of the music, and listening to the music will enhance your enjoyment of the film, and it's of a piece.
Well, Don Was, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
A pleasure.
Don Was directed a documentary film about Brian Wilson called I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. It will be shown on the Disney Channel this Sunday night. It's also playing at the Film Forum in Manhattan, and next month will begin opening theatrically across the country. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel of All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll be hearing about this morning's bombing on a bus in Jerusalem and what its impact is likely to be on the peace process, the dealings between Israel and the Palestinians. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing from Michael Scholar about Rwandan refugees who are now being told to leave Zaire, the country they fled to last year. And we'll be hearing about a controversy in Florida over the proposed closing of a nude beach. Also on today's program, another doctor-assisted suicide attributed to Dr. Jack Kevorkian, and Hungary, which has the world's highest suicide rate. Those stories coming up today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Do you have a favorite word? Linguist Jeff Nunberg does.
There was a story in the Wall Street Journal the other day about a Texas dentist who's building a 110-foot-tall catapult with the aim of hurling a Buick 250 yards through the air. He chose the Buick because it's heavy and because he likes its name. Well, Buick is a great name. Nobody would build a siege engine to throw something called a Lexus or an Altima around. It shows what length some people will go to out of a pure love of words. The story reminded me of Bernard Pivot, who's sort of the Barbara Walters of French literature. For the past 20 years or so, Pivot has been hosting a primetime literary interview show on TV that consistently outdraws Dallas or Dynasty or whatever the other stations throw up against it. One of the stock questions he always asks is, what's your favorite word? The last time I caught his show, the guests were William Styron, who was speaking through an interpreter, and some politician who'd just written a novel. When Pivot asked Styron the question, he seemed a bit at a loss. He launched into a windy evasion. Well, you know, asking a writer to choose a favorite word is like asking a parent to choose a favorite child. Pivot had obviously heard this sort of thing before and cut him off. Merci, he said, and moved on to the politician. He, of course, had seen the show many times before and was ready for the question. La paix, he said, right off. Peace. Pivot arched his eyebrows to show he clearly didn't think a lot of that answer either. He was right, too. I mean, peace may be a wonderful concept, but it's not much of a word, not in French or in English. Now, maybe peas. Actually, it's not an easy question. Some people try to give you what they think are beautiful-sounding words, things like willow or autumn. But that's always a tricky business, because you're never sure how much your impression of the word is colored by its meaning. Max Beerbohm once asked a friend, "Do you not think that ermine is among the most beautiful-sounding words in the language?" Oh, to be sure, his friend replied, and Beerbohm said, well, what about vermin? On the other hand, there are some absolutely gorgeous-sounding words that we tend to overlook because their meanings are unpleasant. Take melanoma. A beautiful word, you want it to be the name of a tropical wind instead of a tumor. You think of something out of a Carmen Miranda song. Smell the tropical aroma carried on the melanoma. Actually, there are a lot of medical words that have that feeling, like diarrhea. What a waste of syllables. Anyway, what we're looking for isn't sound or meaning alone, but the happy wedding of the two. My 5-year-old daughter understood that right off when I asked her what her favorite word was. She said, knucklehead, without a beat, like she'd been thinking about it all afternoon. I don't know that I could be that decisive. I'm not even sure what part of speech I'd start with. I used to have this thing about the preposition athwart, because I always liked the line from Romeo and Juliet about how the queen of the fairies gallops athwart men's noses as they lay asleep. But now, all of a sudden, athwart's gotten trendy. You can't throw a rock without hitting a sentence like, modern Yugoslavia sat athwart the fault lines of European history, or he sets himself athwart the tide of conventional wisdom. Forget this one. Maybe I'd pick a verb, entitle, wallop, or bamboozle. You tell foreigners about bamboozle, they always think it's a much more serious offense than it actually is. Or peruse. A lot of people like this one. Nobody's sure what it means exactly, but people say it anyway just because they like the sound of it. It makes a nice noun, too. I enclose these for your perusal. Perusal. If you didn't know better, you'd think it was Yiddish. What about adjectives? I have a weakness for the ones that go after the noun, like galore, or better, akimbo. I always take a pleasure in working this into a conversation. Oh, nothing, I'm just sitting around, you know, akimbo. This is actually a perfectly good Anglo-Saxon word, but it has this nice exotic lilt to it, akimbo. That's what I'm going to call my blockbuster novel when I get around to writing it. In the end, though, I suppose you have to choose a noun, don't you? Well, if Bernard Pivot ever asks me, I'll pick lap, that ephemeral body part which no other language has a name for, that word that puts the pal in palindrome. Now, that's a noun to make you want to hurl a couple of thousand pounds of metal athwart the bay.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet with Alan Tu. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.